Hey there, we're Mighty Coconut, and welcome to Walkabout Talkabouts, a series of creative discussions between film and gaming luminaries. Let's tune in as they play a round of our studio's VR game, Walkabout Mini Golf. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the next installation of Walkabout Talkabouts. We have Michael Fredrickson here from Pixar Animation Studios. And we're just going to kind of, introduce ourselves and get into it. So I think, Don, you're up first. Do you want to
kick it off? Okay, you bet. I'm Don. I am one of the art directors here at Walkabout. And I'm about to show you how fabulous I am as a golfer. See?
Okay. You wanted to play hard mode, Don.
I did. Yeah, that's like, true. What was I thinking? I was thinking about the light being so nice.
Mm-hmm. Never again. Well, thank you, Don, for I don't feel too intimidated now. I'm Michael Fredrickson. My day job, I'm at Pixar Animation Studios, and I've been here. I'm gonna put here. Whew. Okay, it's hard. It's new to me. Let's see, over the years I've spent an awful lot of time in our sets department. So I think one of the first kind of big sets I worked on was a procedural version of London for a race in Cars 2, and worked a lot on the environments for the first Inside Out, and then also a bunch on the City of the Dead in Coco. That was actually the first one where we used VR more extensively, mm-hmm. and where I kind of got excited and interested about the possibilities of scouting and designing in VR and that type of thing. And after a friend who was a fellow previs artist at Pixar, Philip Metchen, told me about this game and insisted, like, you've got to give it a try. I have been a wild fan. I truly think I play every night. Love it so much. It's my favorite thing, and it's really nice to get to be a fan of something so, so joyful. I love it.
Awesome. I'm Lucas Martel, creator of Walkabout. Michael, I'm actually kind of curious to hear a little bit more about your process there and sort of where, because I know you guys don't use VR necessarily as a studio, but it's sort of it's something that you occasionally drop in, or certain people might use to sort of help them. So yeah, what's that sort of usage like at Pixar?
Yeah, it's a little spotty. I wouldn't say it's like an institutionalized thing where we have a step where we're always going into VR, but there have been certain environments where it's seemed to be really useful to be able to see things in VR ahead of time. So like, mm-hmm. the City of the Dead in Coco was a big one because it was so much of the look was about just this overwhelming complexity, and there were a lot of things early on we said, oh, maybe we can solve this as a map painting, and we don't have to like, mm-hmm. really get into these shots dimensionally and be flying through this world, because we thought, you know, if we've got to build 50 of these towers that have 20,000 buildings and streets and gondolas and scaffolding on all of them, like, it's gonna exhaust all our resources. So
yeah,
getting into VR early, I remember us sort of, you ever make like one of those drip castles at the beach where you have really wet sand?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Drip it up like that. I mean, we made a few models like that to sort of say, hey, what if this was kind of the bounds of a tower? And if mm-hmm. we only built these six, if we could just sort of dress those all over the place, does it give enough variety and shape to be able to sell that this is that these are all unique? And getting mm-hmm. in there and actually flying around ahead of time was one of the only ways we knew to really confidently.
Nice.
Okay, nice shot. Goodness.
Good on you.
To just kind of confidently say we had enough variety. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you found there have been internal aha moments that have happened because you've gone through the effort of prevising in VR?
Yeah. Well, one in particular that stands out to me was when we were trying to answer that exact question on Coco, because I remember what we'd done is I'd modeled a few sort of sweeping spiral
curves that like went by one of the big towers or around and up one of the towers. And mm-hmm. we wrote a little thing in the morning so you could just ride on it like you were on a Disney ride, like you're on the Haunted Mansion. You're being sort of moved along the curve slowly, but you can still look around. So you had this kind of slow motion, almost like being on the train over here and being able to just sort of look around and vibe. And I remember us going along this big sweeping one like this, and we were going by a tower that was like a previous tower, but it had a lot of scaffolding detail and stuff like that. And then we'd put like an early concept painting on sort of the inside of a cylinder, like a big psych behind it. And we saw the tower in silhouette with that off in the distance. And because a bunch of us were simultaneously having this experience, it wasn't like one artist having it alone at their desk and then trying to reproduce that thrill in a review later. It was like the production designer, the director of photography, the director, a few of us kind of all gasped at the same time and were like, oh, that was really beautiful. And so go back, screen record that. And we screen recorded that shot. And then a week later, it was cut into the reels of the movie. And there's a shot with Miguel and Hector on the back of this gondola that moves down in a spiral like this, that I think you can direct, that I think is one of the moments you can really get a sense that you're spatially in that city. Those are some of my favorite parts in movies, is when you're like, this place is real, I can go there. And it's so silently communicated, like, oh, this isn't built out of flats. Like, people live here, they're moving from tower to tower, and you can directly trace that shot, I think, back to that moment that happened, you know, in VR and in kind of in virtual production. And I think that technology was an important part of it, but also the fact that that technology meant that we were in the same room together. Like, it's just the thing I regret so often, is that I have to like have a little surprise discovery by myself at my computer. And now I have to like put on a little show to try to recreate that thrill for a director later. It was more like being really being the audience, that we like got surprised together and then said, let's put it in. But I thought that was really cool.
I love the serendipity of that. And also in a film and other forms of, you know, storytelling, there are lots and lots of compositional things you can do and things you can do in the camera. But the fact that you discovered that shot basically by writing through it is wonderful.
And that I think that was after we did sort of a hopping around, pretending we had a camera and doing sort of a location scout of the models and that kind of thing, and then popping in and out and doing draw overs and stuff, which was a lot.
Actually, that was my next question was, if you guys actually use that as part of like, like a location scout with the directors or sort of like the previs and story artists to really sort of like build out at least a low res version of the set. I realized that it's so hard for you to use it later on because your pipeline is just pushing so many polys through the pipeline that just doesn't work in VR. But yeah, is that kind of the main thing then, is sort of like that early spotting session?
I'd say so far it has been. I'd say the other the other uses I've seen us. Here, one sec here.
Okay.
I'm gonna derail the train.
No.
What is the what a miniature disaster. Oh, the miniature humanity. let's see. I think other times we've used it, it's been like, I remember it being used early on in Turning Red when May's house was being built, and there's a lot of shots in her room and some like shots underneath her bed because she's like, I've got her secret journal under there and sort of some cozy lights and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, that's, it's got this really sort of chunkified aesthetic. And I remember the director of that, Domi, popping into VR to just get a feel for like, how big is this? Where can we get a camera? Like, do we need more room in here to get the kind of shots that I want? But yeah, to your point, ultimately we're working on 2D with sometimes a slight amount of, you know, 3D. If you're seeing it in 3D, we're working on, you know, 2D compositions. And so it's tend to be like, get a feel for the scale, look at the rough blocking, but maybe not as much as stuff's like later in the pipeline.
I would actually love to let just sort of both of you sort of chew the fat a little on something that you brought up, which is sort of environmental storytelling, and it's something that I also come from a film world, but Don comes from the theme park world. You were at Disney Imagineering and a ton of other theme park stuff. I'm kind of curious to just sort of like the difference or sort of like how you guys at Pixar go about environmental storytelling and sort of like just how that works, like you would or different than you would with a theme park.
Yeah,
absolutely. I have those questions too. I have the game and I have the theme park background, but I don't have the film background. I know that in placemaking, a lot of it is just establishing rapport with the audience or with your person who's entering it. The last thing you want to do is have it be terrifying and off-putting when you arrive. So a tremendous amount of the design process at the beginning is reassurance that the thing that they think they're going to see, we're delivering upon. And then once they feel comfortable, then we can surprise them and delight them with the ways in which we've interpreted it in ways that they hadn't imagined. Originally we talked about this course starting in God mode, if that was technically possible, so that you would go like, I don't understand why I'm here and how do I play golf? But as soon as you triggered first ball and you realize you had shrunk down, this very simple environment became incredibly complex because now you were small. That wasn't technically possible. So you start small, which is still delightful and wonderful.
Well, I think one of the things I've always felt, honestly, a little jealous about in, Imagineering or what you all are doing at Walkabout, is how sort of pure the environmental storytelling is. Mm-hmm. You're not being asked to come in here and like listen to characters speak to each other or focus on them emoting or going through things, which is its own language and its own challenge and all that. But trying to solve the problem of how do you get those things across simply with the placement of objects and the way you feel when you're in a space is like the holy grail for sets for us, I'd say, you know. So for us, we're certainly usually talking about history and character, and which I suppose you could call the story of the environment, but you know, it's this character maintaining a messy apartment. Is it is it unbelievably rigidly arranged because this person's all about the hierarchy and structure and order? Has this gone through accidents? Has it been handled carefully? Not handled carefully. That like those types of questions are big. And then I suppose for us also, there's the practical considerations of like, can we tell the story in this space?
Your environment is a supporting role. In fact, if your environment in film draws attention, it's actually a deterrent. It's not what you want. It has to support the narrative and the characters.
I would say jokingly, my fellow environment artists and I will often complain about the note of being told the work is distracting. Yeah. Because it's so persistent.
You make it too good.
Interesting. And I don't disagree, and it is important, but sometimes it's exciting to just get to show off a little bit. Yeah. And so it was a lot of fun working on those big reveal shots in Coco where you see the city and it's really a focus on that environment. I think as a theme parks fan, that was a real dream to try to make a moment like that in a show that hopefully there'd be a little kid who saw it and they blew their mind and they said, that's what I want to do with my life. I want to make places like that. I dream that one day I'll work with somebody who said that was the first shot that lit them up and made them want to do this. I also remember when I worked for a few years early on Soul, and there's some bits in Soul near the end where Joe is sort of contemplating all these beautiful, quieter moments in his life after having really focused on trying to make it big in this jazz band. And he's at the piano and he's remembering playing with his father who's passed away and being with his mother at the beach. And as he's thinking about it, there's these shots that get progressively wider and wider. And you see him in his apartment and then him from outside the window and then New York and then down near Battery Park and then all of New York with Central Park and then Earth and then a nebula, and it's, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger. And I remember in the Guardian's review of Soul, it had this little one-off sentence that said, I'm paraphrasing, but that I didn't realize that these quiet, like silent views of New York could make me feel so strongly. I think in this weird little movie, in this weird little story or something. And just seeing that one line about this sort of simple shot of like the vastness of a city and thinking about all the stories of everybody living in it and seeing it all at once, and that was this really strong feeling. I think obviously that shot in isolation doesn't mean anything. So it's, you know, it's all the character work and the story beforehand, and the fact that it's a beautiful shot that are working together to make it like a meaningful spectacle or a meaningful awe-inspiring thing. But as just a moment of pride from the work that just being in the environment itself does to communicate the story, I was really excited to see someone feel that way. Because it's, in some ways, I think it's easier to think about the work that just being in the environment is doing in a space like this when you don't have the story to talk about, too.
Interestingly, one of our challenges is to not tell a deep story. We really, really want to leave it open for interpretation, because the interpretation is going to be infinitely richer than anything that we spoon feed them. And the theme park business runs into this a lot, too. Tony Baxter will often say that attraction was a book report where you've just relived scenes from the movie, as opposed to something like Pirates, where I don't know what the story is, but boy, do I feel like I'm in this environment. And so we strive for that in our, you know, we succeed more in times and less than others. But if we leave it open-ended enough that the player can apply their own journey and their own guess at what we're implying narratively, then we've succeeded.
Yeah, it really does have to be a lot simpler too, just to sort of like sell the idea, because we don't have a narrative. We don't usually, like 8-bit layer was the one exception where we actually did have some text of the bad guy that sort of walked you through it. But yeah, we can't sort of explain the world. It has to reveal itself entirely visually, which I mean, you guys also have to do that, but yeah, it's just a different operation.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a big fan of the first, I mean, all of it, but the first third of WALL-E, you know, having no dialogue, I think is a really, you know, a time when we're really revealing things strictly visually. And I think, I remember on Soul, I was doing some research on like personality science, because there's some bits in that movie where the souls will go to the personality pavilions and find out if they're going to be aloof or musical or or inspired down on Earth. And so we were just kind of reading up to how do people tend to talk about personality, like in more formal contexts. And I remember finding this interesting paper about how when you give a personality test to an adult, you might ask something like, okay, at a party, I tend to be the life of the party or go off in the corner and I'm quite quiet. And they were saying adults will refer to this sort of abstract informational idea about what they tend to do, like a story about this is what I have often done in the past at a party, and then try to answer on behalf of thinking about that. And they were like, when we test this on kids, like 7-year-olds, 6-year-olds, and we're trying to talk about their personality, they don't have that abstract story about themselves. They're much more just direct. And so those researchers will use a picture and say, look, this man just dropped an armful of books, and here's a kid helping him pick them up, and here's a kid, you know, just giving him the finger and walking the other way. and asking, like, which of these feels more like you, more like what you would do. And I love thinking about that for why it's worth aspiring to just revealing things visually. When you just get something because, like, this character's small in a big, big world, or things are really stark and sharp and have like cold colors, and there's a lot of darkness, and you just get it at that, like you'd understand it when you were a kid without thinking about it or having anybody dictate anything to you. I feel like that is the ultimate goal, is can you get it, you know, without any language.
That's my opinion. that's something that I've noticed, especially in VR, is that since we're all physical creatures, we all know when a door's too tall or a door's too small. So if you want people to feel like something's cramped, you can actually kind of manipulate the emotional response based upon how it relates to humans' relationship to scale, as an example, or that's color, right. Certainly, and lighting, and all those things that we are familiar with in theater and film. But because you're relating to something spatially, and even when it's something like, we all know this is a wooden block. Why do we know it? Because we've experienced wooden blocks. But upon scrutiny, it's like, this is not a wooden block, you know? Yeah. So we're willing to suspend our disbelief, and we're willing to relate to it almost subconsciously. We're not even talking about it. It's just, we all get it because of our life experience as physical people.
I'm always shocked that I can look at a lowercase g in two different fonts and know it's a lowercase g.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a pretty amazing brain
transcript.
We can do that.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to move on to the next poll. There's a cookie that's calling our name.
That's really bad. Well, the remains of one.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that one of the other things, not to focus too much on Walkabout, but the other thing that we do have that is kind of our character is that we also have to fit mini golf in there. So there is there is that second master that we're always kind of having to serve, and it does dictate some stuff, but it also does seem to provide a good structure, just like you guys. I mean, I know that there are some just general sort of like 3-act structure that a lot of your films use, and a lot of sort of like general storytelling conceits that sort of provide that foundation. Ours just happens to be 18 holes of mini golf is how it tends to break down.
But usually pretty nice to have something to at least get you started.
I think it does help a lot. Just having something, some structure, some bones to sort of hang it on. I'm actually kind of curious about that with some of the story stuff that you guys do at what point do you guys on the environmental side of things start to get involved and sort of start to dictate or start to influence the story versus how much of that ends up kind of coming before you guys are involved?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I would say one of the sort of unplanned times that I have gotten most excited as a environment artist is when we've made enough of a previs version of a set that the next round of storyboards, you start to see shapes in the background that resemble what you made for the first time. It's a really sort of silent and undiscussed thing of like, I always loved, we had a talk one time from Jim Bissell, who's production designed all kinds of stuff, but E.T. is highest in my mind of just like first movie that ever made me cry and just forever a favorite. And I loved this thing he said of, at the beginning of a movie, everybody is making a slightly different version of the movie in their own head. And that part, and so I often like to talk about, like, on the first Inside Out, the first time I heard somebody say they're going to be shelves of long-term memory spheres, and I thought about our whole sets team hearing that and thinking, I wonder how many different pictures are in all these people's heads right now, like, and how different they are from the picture that's in my head. And that the point of like putting up some pictures and looking at them, and even when you say, you know, memory shelf, like almost like a caveman, like and you point at that picture and you go, associate these two things. And we go, well, we don't like that, but that, you know, that that's really important too, as we're starting to congeal towards having a similar picture. And I've always loved the moment where you start to see that happen of like, without even discussing it, we've all seen these similar images enough that we start to sort of silently agree, okay, yeah, that's what the world looks like. And I think it's one of the sort of hard to quantify important things about us still working physically together in the same place instead of like breaking up the work and sharing it across studios or that type of thing. I think it's those moments where like the work of one department feeds back into another one, or I'm remembering on Soul early on, there was a experiment where one of our artists had done the counselors that are like these kind of wire sculptures. And it was sort of a riff on, you know, what if they were just made out of these like bent wires and they were sort of these things struggling to appear human, these kind of higher dimensional things struggling to appear like what they thought humans were, but didn't quite understand it. Almost like how you guys talk about the creature in Meow Wolf trying to communicate to you through mini golf, mm-hmm. which it doesn't understand. Mm-hmm. Sort of end of 2001 zoo type business. And mm-hmm. I remember one of those sculptures being made physically, and it's all getting in a dark room and taking an iPhone light and just moving it around like this and watching all these sort of trippy, distorted shadows happening and having another mm-hmm. one of those moments of we're all in one place. Oh, that's cool. And almost in the moment, remembering folks going, yeah, like Pete saying, I think there's possibility there and mm-hmm. we're going to go that way. And I love those moments where it's like, yeah, we've never had a character like that. That was just a line that could reconfigure itself, that could pop in and out of the ground, but there's a fun to it. And like, I wonder if some of those spontaneous things, I think they happen more often when you're in a shared space. So if you're not going to be in a physical shared space, I think maybe that's partially one of the things that's always seemed exciting to me, that you all start these sketches collaboratively in Gravity Sketch and can fly around and be surprised or say, hey, look at this, or grab somebody else's work. And, you know, that I think it makes it's like I call it almost like farming luck for trying to like increase the probability that you might have a charming surprise, you know, or something.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, we start almost all the courses in a design retreat originally with Lucas Henning and I, and we could technically do that remotely because we're just going into an Airbnb somewhere in the world and we're putting on our headsets and being in VR. But it's the physical proximity that allows us to get a lot of work done because we're in the same physical space. And then all that groundwork is what informs all the non-physical interactions that happen afterward.
Huh. Yeah, so, definitely found that when we don't do a physical design session for something, it definitely suffers, and we've got to focus a lot more to really sort of nail the design or sort of get all on the same page. I know we actually ran into that with a course not too long ago that it didn't get that design, and we got it there, but it did take a lot more late in the game reworking of stuff to really sort of like make it cohesive. And we've definitely just learned that lesson. There's something about meet space of actually being in the same physical location for at least a chunk of time that does wonders.
So yeah, we did that with Around the World. I mean, pardon me, Journey to the Center of the Earth, I think we did it in an hour, and it was super scribbly. Anybody looking from the outside would go, I have no idea what I'm looking at. But we had, three of us went, that's it. And from that point on, it just was a process of a year of fleshing that out. But it was all figured out in those squiggly lines during that session.
I'm curious, I'm thinking, when COVID hit, we were almost done with Soul. It only had a few more months of like heavy production, and again, this is sort of just my observation and opinion, but I thought that for how new it was for us to be working remotely suddenly, I thought that that process went surprisingly smoothly finishing the movie. And I think it's because enough of us had a similar picture in our head of what a shot in Seoul looks like. And we kind of knew the recipes. We knew how to make something live in the world it needed to live in. We knew what needed to be done to finish it. We were all warmed up and congealed as a crew, and we could just keep going. And but the place where I thought it really was much more difficult is those of us, folks who are in a part in the sort of like, we don't even know what this is yet. We're looking to play and be surprised and be together and stumble upon things and sit and find the heart of this thing. That is, I find, extra hard to do when you're not physically together or it's disjointed, because you just don't know where the inspiration's going to come from or the surprise. And at least for me, I need to be in a kind of a good mood, or at least like I like be around people. I feel like I can play with, and I'm not in isolation, and we buoy each other, or you get some ideas from outside your own head. And I just think it's important. I think when you're trying to do something in a more disjointed, remote way, it's more well suited to things that are really quantifiable, easy to package up. The, you know, the way teams communicate to each other is clear. But if you're trying to make something that's never existed, I think it can be harder.
Yeah, agree.
Though very interesting to me that this came out of COVID and feels in some ways like one of the best solutions you can have to that problem if you can't be together physically.
Well, often in the theme park world, and I'm sure it's the same at Pixar, is the brainstorming process is the rule is there's no bad ideas, so it's safe to come up with anything. But there's something that happens when you bring lunch in. Everybody eats lunch, and about 2:30, everybody's like ready for a nap, and they're getting kind of punchy. And inevitably, the dumb, really stupid ideas come out. And it's that moment when someone goes, "What about this?" And everybody gets a good laugh. And then somebody goes, "Wait a minute, that's interesting." And then it takes an entirely different direction because of the hours you put into coming up with the obvious ideas left you open to the really off the wall things that made it fresh.
Yeah, because maybe that's some of that. You've got the confidence that you explored the basics. You're feeling good about it. You needed to. It almost reminds me of, and I'm not one to be talking about drawing to you, Don, but I've heard people say you've got 10,000 bad drawings in you, and you just have to get them out. So I've always liked that phrasing when it comes to practicing anything, really.
My other motto, especially for students who are just learning, is that a good idea can be communicated with a bad sketch, but a bad idea doesn't matter how beautiful the sketch is, it's still a bad idea. So scribbling it down on a napkin can sometimes change the whole direction of a design, even if it's stick figures.
I love that. And I often the last 2 years run our internship program for technical directors at Pixar. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, it can be such a temptation to say that what you've come to learn is to learn how to use our pipeline or use the tools or learn. That's important. And we do learn that. But I like to say that part of the problem doesn't have a PR issue. You can go find plenty of information about how to do those things. The thing I get most excited about teaching or like trying to help them with is I like to tell students that the most under-discussed skill in being an artist is almost like the step you have to take before you can think about running a marathon is being able to make something and then not be mean to yourself about it. that you can make something and not look at it and be so judgmental and say, "That doesn't look good, so I'm not good. I'm a bad person. I don't practice hard enough. I'm a terrible artist." Then that feels really bad. And then you're so disincentivized by how bad that feels to trying to do another drawing or make another model that you never get the practice that's going to change the thing that is distressing you. And I just feel like for how simple that is, I don't remember being told that. And just to be there with someone and be encouraging about the fact that if they made anything and they were willing to put themselves out there to make something, that is a step. And if you can take many, many, many more steps and not be so critical that you prevent yourself from walking, then at least you got a shot.
I think this is kind of related. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Don.
I remind clients, especially when I'm freelancing, that sometimes my job is to draw what it isn't, because even if it's a beautiful drawing, Don, you haven't nailed the idea. It's like, well, now we know what it isn't, so I'll have some value.
Clearly, you didn't tell me that wasn't the idea before I started drawing, did you?
We thought this was the idea, but now that we see it, nope.
Now we both know.
I will also say that's also one of the best skills that other people also don't talk about, Don, is that you have this amazing ability to sort of like reset, that once you find something that it isn't, you're able to sort of just like pull it out of your memory. You remember the shadow of like, okay, it's not that, but you also sort of like don't fall in love with it.
I quietly cry. Yeah. No, I just go cry quietly.
I know I've made you cry a couple of times when we've killed your babies.
Yes,
but
yes you have, and vice versa. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I also wonder, this is kind of tying even with what you were just saying, Michael, is that I think that one of the advantages that we have is that because we're doing these environments, it's a single environment. It might have multiple different rooms, but it's also low poly. And so we have this benefit of sort of working fast and loose. And, you know, there's a lot of polish, but it's not like back when I was doing animation and you would spend 4 or 5 years on a single movie. And how do you balance that freshness and being able to sort of get inspired and know what something is and then sort of like, but then keep carrying it on for, I mean, probably, like how long are you guys typically on a movie when you're working on it?
About that. You know, I'd say, well, for what I do, maybe the max nowadays is like two years-ish, you know, because a movie is probably, you know, from concept to release more like 5 years, but, you know, you're different sizes of crew as you move through that, you know, smaller to bigger. And so, like, at least with the job I've done in the past, I would get involved, you know, later once we're saying, we're pretty much sure this is the world, let's start specking out what that is and that type of thing.
Yeah.
But I'd say part of the way I've dealt with it is, you know, I make music outside of work and have this strange instrument that's like a syringe I can dip into these different tubes to inject and extract the bass or the drums or the vocals. Mm-hmm. And I play with that live a lot. I love tinkering on it and just trying to improve it. But also I've noticed that it almost feels like an antidote to how long we have to be focused.
Yeah.
I can make decisions in front of an audience and immediately see, did that work or not work? Mm-hmm. And so I find I try to like complement the longer projects at work with things that have the opposite sort of shape, you know, outside. Mm-hmm. Or that's the story I've come up with after the fact, I suppose, from noticing what I gravitate to. But I also, a thing I don't love about movies is that I don't often get to really be there when somebody's experience, you know, I hear from my own immediate family, like, we saw it, it was nice. You know, after the fact. So you can go with someone, but, you know, there's this big delay, like, you know, we release it, a few months go by, then it's out, we're still excited about it, but it becomes this different thing, but, you know, by then. And so there are other strengths to the experience that I enjoy, but that is a sort of part of the shape of like, do you get to be there in the immediate when the experience is happening, that like I like to get from other things to balance it out, I guess.
Oh yeah, totally. You also mentioned something else that even with what we were talking about just a minute ago too, is sort of like this, the team size and how in an animated film, it tends to start off very, very small and it sort of like grows up until, you know, a peak and then it kind of comes back down again as people, basically departments wrap up their parts on it. Have you found, especially in that sort of the creative, that early upfront phase, is there sort of a balance to sort of like, you want to have enough, the right people involved, but not too many? Like, is there a magic number that you guys have found for that process?
Well, I would say, you know, in general, it's a little awkward to feel like you're speaking on behalf of this enormous, incredible institution of ludicrously talented people. So I sort of don't want to, by answering it, like, imply the you know, I think there are lots of different answers for that depending on what part of the problem
people are taking on.
And so, maybe I'll just try to like speak for myself, maybe on projects both in and out of Pixar, that I felt that the number of people is maybe important just for folks having a voice. And for not, I often think by the time you've got lots and lots of people involved, it's maybe because you have so much work that you have to split it up to get it done. Mm-hmm. More than the number, And I don't know how to do this with like more than 10 people, I suppose, but yeah. More than the number, the thing I find really important is just like, is this group of people supportive to each other? Some people seem to be able to create an environment where they're like locking horns like bucks and screaming at each other and trolling each other and being cruel about each other's ideas and feel like that sharpens it up. I'm a bit softer and when an idea is like brand new and I'm a little unsure about it and I'm still trying to figure out if it's the right thing, I prefer to be in an environment where like, not that people are being kind to a bad idea, but just that we're going slowly and that there's not a, that I find it easier to just to say whatever comes to mind if you feel safe effectively with the group you're with. And I think, yeah, it's actually something I've noticed in Walkabout, oddly, when I've jumped into games that have four or five people, sometimes I've gotten groups, seems to be especially with all male groups, where folks can get like a little bit more competitive. And I wonder if it's because it's harder to know what the sort of lowest common denominator of how everybody feels is. And I've experienced it less in one-on-one games because there's no one else to put on a show for. It's just you. It's not a whole lot of fun to be a troll to one person. There's an intimacy to it that seems related to group size and just how many different mindsets you need to try to imagine and that sort of thing.
Yeah, totally.
It's just darn cozy in here. Were you thinking about being the size of a mouse?
Well, that's the punchline.
Yeah,
yeah. Kind of. That came up early or fairly early-ish on, but it wasn't like the initial design. It was just something that we needed.
The tagline for this is that you get to be a creature that's stirring.
That's actually right.
So fun to stir.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Wesley's recording, so I'll sort of like launch us back into this. Just picking back up the conversation about the team size. Yeah, we definitely feel that there is a point where you sort of like have so many people contributing. At a certain point, as it gets further and further into the process, you kind of have to break parts up in order to have the right number of people working on something. Cause yeah, just like 30 people all at once, sort of like throwing their ideas in just becomes too chaotic. But also, yeah, you really got to break it up. But I think that some of that also comes from, even though we put out these courses every 6 to 8 weeks, we're typically working on them for about a year, which that's way less time than working on a film, but it feels like it's still able to be a little bit more fresh. Yeah, I guess I'm just kind of curious how do you keep an idea fresh when you're working on it for so long?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it makes me curious about that and the time scale of like an attraction in Imagineering, Don.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the attractions are very much like film. They take 3 to 5 years if it's a really big attraction. And it starts out with probably 2 or 3 people, and then it's 3,000 by the time the construction happens and it's in the field.
Wow.
And so it's up to, I think, those handful of people at the beginning to set sort of rules of engagement, simple ones, that allow those people that you'll never meet to be able to make choices that reinforce that simple concept. We do that, I think, here at Walkabout, because one of the really fresh things is that once you hand it to someone, whether we're handing it to Emma or Tad, they kind of own it. It's theirs, and they have been given permission to add and build upon, as opposed to ask any of us permission as to what your intent was. Where it hasn't worked as well is when that intent is a little vague, and then it leaves someone a little bit floundering as to how they should contribute. But if it's a strong vision or a strong set of rules, then they go with it and they take it places that are delightful and surprise you. And that goes all the way through our tech art team that are usually in a tremendous crunch to get all the pieces working together, and yet they still sort of like elves have the permission to do magical little, whether it's sound effects or politics particle effects or lighting choices that have have been given self-permission to support those early ideas that came up at the very, very beginning.
And you saying that those rules of engagement need to be simple kind of reminds me of the sort of intentional vagueness of the story in here so that you can bring your own story to it. And similarly, like leaving those simple but clear, hopefully lets people bring their own style and their own things they're excited about, rather than like over specifying it to the point that, you know, only the very important people can tell you what needs to be done.
Right. You know, I'd say, yeah, those very important people aren't able to be in every meeting at every moment. And they don't want to be. They want you to take it to the next level.
I have always enjoyed the term of like working on a crew where the director is working more like a gardener than a carpenter.
There you go. And
that it's more about how do I create the conditions where this group is going to produce stuff where I have a huge bounty of great ideas to choose from, instead of saying only I can come up with the great ideas and I will do it in isolation and then I will dole them out to people I don't trust to get those things done, whether it's on a film or otherwise. I prefer to say, let's build up a team full of people that we all that we trust, and if you're on the team, you deserve to be on the team, and we do it together, and we say, everybody, you know, bring your best, and every idea's got a shot to be the idea. Let's judge it on the basis of the idea, not the creator of the idea.